books that we're raffling are up in front there on the end, and I forgot to mention last night that we have had a contribution of a wonderful gift basket that will also be in the raffle, and I think she's gone upstairs to get it so we can have it here for you to see. There's a list. She's typed out all the items that are in it, and it's just chock full of really, really some cool stuff. So you can take a look at that. I'm going to have the tickets on my arm all day. They're $1 a piece, and all the proceeds just go to their foundation so that we can run even more advertising next year. So hit me up for that if you want to buy some raffle tickets, and then we'll be doing the raffle tonight at the dinner. Janet, where'd you end up? Janet Jacobson has a short little announcement. She had a little experience this morning. Talk loud. So if you need any sports equipment, you know where to go. I made a decision because we have got the bios printed on the program that we wouldn't take time, for like formal introductions of our speakers, which sometimes can eat up our time. So I'm sure you've had a chance to look those over, and each of our speakers will be giving some of their own personal stories anyway when they stand up to do their presentation. So we're just very, very pleased to have Tal Bachman with us this morning, and some of you have been aware of his story to some extent, and I know he posts a lot over on the RFM board. And those of us who are on the other email list don't know as much about Tal, but I've had a chance to talk to him two or three times on the phone, and it's just like we just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk because there's just so much of the experiences that we share in common. And so without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to Tal, and I've asked him to please leave at least 15 minutes at the end for questions. I'm sure you'll probably have some, and we'll turn the time to Tal. Bye.
Do you mind turning the light on?
Yeah.
Hi. Just waiting for the lights to dim so I can see the teleprompter. I guess I want to begin by explaining the polygamy joke that my wife made yesterday during her report. I asked her what that was all about, and she said she was talking about the fact that I'd been willing to have 8 children with her or something, and I thought it sort of sounded like she was saying something else. But anyway, I was going to say it's great to be here. I guess it's still a little bit surreal for me to be here. I don't know. Sometimes when I hear the stories of some of the other people, it kind of seems like there was a self there that felt sort of contorted and molded and being sort of constricted into a box, and sort of in this journey for self-authenticity, they finally had to like break out of the church or something, and I was not like that. I didn't really have any complaints. I thought everything was great. So, I guess in some ways I'm still wondering how much I might even have in common with some folks here. But anyway, on to my remarks. Maybe one thing, just I noticed last night, like a lot of folks, seemed a little bit defensive because of this lingering, well, they can leave the church, but they can't leave it alone. There they are. In Salt Lake City, church is true. Church, you know. I guess I just wanted to sort of throw my 2 cents in before I start talking about my own journey. Like every Fast Sunday when we were Mormons, we gathered in the sacrament in a chapel and talked about how grateful we were to have left the world and reality. And I don't really understand exactly what the difference is. I mean, I think you sort of make a case, like, you can leave reality, but you can't leave it alone. There you go. Always talking about it, always sort of like trying to reconvince yourself that everything's great. So, I mean, I don't think that anybody has a reason to be defensive. I mean, we were in an organization that, most of us believed in wholeheartedly, and it turned out not to be what it claimed. And when you've been stuck on, sort of a treadmill at 18 months old when you first enter nursery and you grow up sort of viewing the world through this prism, you just can't sort of realize that you've been had at 25 or 35 or 45 and, that was an interesting part of my life, so what's that, what next? It just doesn't work that way. So I think it's sort of unfair, and I hope nobody feels defensive about talking about our experiences and trying to make sense of them. Well, anyway, so I've prepared a few notes. So, as Sue said, I'll try to leave some time at the end for questions. I thought I'd begin here. I got into my car. We lived on a little island off the coast of British Columbia for a few years called Salt Spring Island. And one November night in 2003, I got into my car and got onto the ferry to go to the Stake Center in Victoria. I was going because my branch president, to whom I had confided I was having a crisis in faith, had recommended that I go see him. He actually pressed me for details, my branch president. And I was so sick and felt so shell-shocked, and we were very close. He's an elderly fella, but that I didn't want to say anything because I thought he might believe that I was onto something. And this is a guy who put in tens of thousands of hours, I'm sure, for decades for the church, paying out of pocket for ferry trips like three times a week from this island down to Vancouver Island. I didn't have the heart. So I didn't have any idea what the stake president could possibly say that would make any difference, because by that time I had gone over everything 100 times and done all the math every which way that I could figure and every which way that anybody else could seem to figure, since I'd combed through every apologetic site I could find and all kinds of things. But I remember that sort of terrible journey, the dark night and sort of shaking and just completely shell-shocked, that terrible nausea and this sort of weird sort of shrieking in the back of my head that I couldn't get rid of. And I felt that way for like 3 weeks, two or three weeks. It just doesn't make sense, and I don't know what else to do, and I don't know what other conclusion to come to. And I thought as I was driving down there that if I could find a way to unknow what I knew, that I would do it. Because I'd do anything to stop that terrible, excruciating pain. So I'd had a premonition, though, about my meeting. And my premonition was that I would walk in, burst into tears, be unable to make any kind of sense, and I would leave just as miserable and confused as I'd come in, because he wouldn't be able to respond to anything that I said, because I wouldn't have been able to say anything that made any sense. So I had taken the opportunity to type out a 3-page letter, and so that was on the seat next to me. Well, I got to the stake center, said hello to the stake president, very amiable, very low-key, kind of a Spencer Kimball guy, like not your typical, like, Ezra Taft Benson butt-kicking, multi-millionaire kind of guy. Not like that at all. Very, very unassuming guy, very nice. Went in there, sat down, handed him my letter, and sure enough, started weeping. He sort of sat there in silence, like reading through the letter. I don't know, as I sat there, I just began reflecting over my whole life as a member of the church and how I had no idea now what would come next. And I didn't even really want to, like, never not be a member. I never gave my attention. So I thought I'd tell, just share a few things about my life and then sort of maybe at the end talk about why I think it's important to seek for truth and to act on it. Insofar as we can ascertain truth, to act on it. I had sort of an unusual childhood. My My dad was a rock star, and my mother was a religious zealot that thought rock stars were evil. It's really confusing. But Mom, you married him. My dad was a convert, and my mom was sort of like the primary gospel person in the house, and she was very devout. And I don't know if it had something to do with not having been in Utah. You know, like Scottish people get more Scottish the farther away from Scotland they get, and you know they're wearing tartans, and you know. So I don't know if it was like that, but you know, it was like Mormon doctrine is, you know, like absolutely no face cards, no nothing on Sunday, and absolutely no cola drinks. Elder McConkie said it was against the spirit of the Word of Wisdom, and you know, later when I came to Utah. It seemed like everybody was having a party, and you know? I couldn't believe it. You know, it's like, what it was, you know, like, all those rumors are true that I heard about Utah Mormons, and they play catch on Sunday. I sort of learned about the gospel mostly from my mom, and I guess we all did, and learned everything that I'm sure most of you learned. Including some of, you know, some things that are maybe not stressed as often now, but kind of were still around in the 70s when I was growing up, like, you know, where God lived. And I noticed that, you know, other kids at school had never heard of these planets that, you know, God lived on. It's, you know, strange. Learned that some of the kids looked different than we did in our class because they had not been brave in this giant battle in the pre-existence, and so they'd been born with a curse. Excuse me. The curse was to be a Negro. So I sort of grew up with all the other kids kind of being grateful that I wasn't like them, that I'd been brave with everybody else in my clan, I guess. Well, long story short is my mom, I think for probably good reasons within the world that she inhabited, came to feel that my dad posed something of a spiritual danger. He did play catch with us sometimes on Sundays. He missed church a couple times. What else was? Oh, yeah, he sped. Sometimes he would speed, and that's like, you know, 12th article of faith, you know, coming right up, Mom, you know, cue Mom, you know, we believe in honoring you, you know, so there's a constant tension. In fact, my mom told us once, I hope this doesn't embarrass her or whatever, but my mom told us once when I was a kid that the Lord had told her that when people speed, they don't get to their destinations any faster than they would have if they'd obeyed the speed limit. Because God just sort of arranged it that way. And I remember thinking, like, so often when I was a kid, you know, I don't really understand that. But one day when I become spiritually mature, and when I'm an adult, I'll understand these kinds of things. Well, you know, obviously that never happened. My parents got a divorce. I went to live with my dad. So that was cool. It was like courtship of Eddie's father thing. It was me and him. And then the other, like, five siblings were at my mom's house for a while. And then they actually gradually ended up coming over to my dad's house. So, but I was always active. My dad was always active. And abbreviating somewhat, you know, things were sort of unremarkable. I had, to me, very riveting spiritual experiences on occasion that convinced me that, in fact, you know, we were in the one true way. Even as a kid, you know, young teenager. But as I sort of neared the end of high school, I started to wonder, like a lot of kids, all kinds of things. And I remember I used to go in and visit my long-suffering bishop, Bishop Hargraves, and ask him these questions. You know, like, you know, hey, like, there's like 5 billion people, and this is like 86 or something, 5 billion people on this planet, and I guess I'm just wondering, like, how could, like, we be the only ones? And, you know, like, a lot of these other people are, they speak the same way we speak about knowing absolutely, with absolute certainty, and all these kinds of questions, and how did that make sense? And he would sort of do his best to sort of parry and thrust. And I had dinner with him about a year ago, and he said, you know, I always hated it when you came into my office. But you always asked me questions that made me really uncomfortable and that I couldn't really answer. Well, he's out of the church now, too. Well, anyway, there's this concept in hypnosis, fractionation. where once somebody sort of slips into a hypnotic trance and then comes out, then the next time they're put in, they go in extra deep. Like sometimes, I don't know what it is, I'm not a psychologist or anything, but sometimes you see with people that are battling drug or alcohol addictions or whatever, they'll get sober and then something happens and they go on a bender like there's no tomorrow. So I kind of feel like maybe something like that happened to me. Because I feel like, you know, for a while there, I was sort of like almost kind of seeing things. I was so close, you know, I could sort of, it seemed like I could sort of feel reality through the wall of this membrane, but I couldn't really quite, I didn't actually have any reason to believe. I didn't know of any sort of like internal inconsistencies in our story of the world. So that sort of makes it difficult to reject it as a whole theory. Like Mormonism, when you're in it, when you've been born in it, has enough connecting points to reality for a while there to make it seem sort of plausible. And are there things you have to put on the shelf? Of course, yeah, absolutely. Things that don't add up. But I don't know. There are enough things so that I couldn't make the leap. Well, the big 1-9 approach, then a lot of guys can, you know, remember this sort of, you know, this backdrop of pressure, even if it's not articulated. It's like, you know, are you going to get your testimony? I know the church is. Well, I start to really wonder, and I didn't want to go if I didn't really have a testimony. It wasn't like one of these guys that was like, you know, I want to wait till I get out there and see what happens. And I really came to feel absolutely that I was in the one true way. And however improbable it had seemed to me 6 months ago, listening to like Ziggy Marley, Bob Marley's son, talk about how he had communicated with Jah, and Jah had told him that Rastafarianism was the one true way, and it sounded very much like the Joseph Smith story. And I was like, well, how do I make sense of that? But it didn't matter, because their experiences are not real, but mine are real. They don't really feel the spirit, but I do. And they're not really convinced. They just think they're really convinced. So I started reading, and sure enough, you know, I think maybe it had something to do with the lack of self-discipline that I practiced after graduating from high school, where I sort of slept in a lot and went to the beach. But, you know, as I started to study, and, you know, I really started to feel a sense of purpose and momentum. And the summer of 87, I moved down to my mom's house in Logan, and decided to go on a mission. And I was just totally into it. And I kind of went cuckoo. I read all of her church books. I hung out at the Utah State Institute Library reading through all of their books, like Joseph Fielding Smith, a caveman, or the descendants of Adam who regressed because they sinned. And, you know, I kind of said, wow, cool. And I'm boning up for my mission. In fact, I went so crazy that I signed up for an entire semester of nothing but institute classes, which I think is like fairly unusual. I was like, don't you want to take any university classes? No way. And I read the stories of Wilford Woodruff. I vowed that I was going to be a missionary just like Wilford, who went to England and baptized hundreds and hundreds at the Benbow Farm, and all these great stories. Really pumped up. Well, as it happened, I got a preliminary taste of what it would be like to be Wilford Woodruff before my mission. And that was, some of you might know this story. That was when I found out that U2, who I had idolized, the band U2, for, you know, the whole time I was growing up, were on the tour for the Joshua Tree album. And they were coming to Vancouver to play. And so I called up my dad, who, you know, had connections and everything, and I said, Dad, do you think you could get us in backstage to see U2? Well, U2 had sort of started off as like, college act, popular with college students, and they'd sort of been gradually rising in popularity. And I'd been following them the whole time, and they were just breaking out. They were just becoming the biggest band in the world. And so, in fact, they were playing BC Place Stadium, which is a huge place. So my dad called me. Down. He said, I heard you're going to Argentina. And I said, yeah, I am. And that was pretty much all the opening I needed. And just to sort of explain, U2 then, as now, is very involved with humanitarian issues and Amnesty International and, you know, third world kinds of things. So I guess that was why he had agreed to meet with me, because he'd heard I was going on a humanitarian mission for a couple of years. I was not really clear when I went in what exactly Dad had said, but it would become clear as we spoke. Well, his question about Argentina was the only thing that I needed, and so I just went right in. You know, I was like, you know, I have a special gift for you. You know, and produced my inscribed Book of Mormon to Bono with my testimony. Told him the Holy Spirit had told me that it was absolutely true. And, you know, it was funny, but the sort of, you know, what it's like, you know, you think, well, it's like, I have the Spirit, you know, and the Spirit witnesses to all truth, so I'm going to, like, zap him with my Spirit. Like, once I say that I know it's true, it's pretty much a done deal, if he's sincere. Now, the only reason that, like, he could sort of doubt is, like, if he's insincere. He doesn't really want to be good or know the truth. Well, obviously, Bono did. You know, Bono means good in Latin. You know, it makes sense. He didn't really have the kind of reaction I was expecting. I couldn't make sense of it at the time. He seemed a little bit peeved and, like, in shock. And he said something about extreme doctrines and something about extreme doctrines. He started to kind of mumble, and he's kind of looking down, like, what have I gotten myself into? And I realized later that they had, just like in the weeks prior to this, they had been very active in the battle in Arizona to get the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday passed, and they had protested it. And Bono, as I found out later, as I read about it, was very aware of Evan Meekum and that Evan Meekum's views on the pickaninnies, as he, you know, yeah, you like to refer to the blacks as, had some connection with the comments of Mormon leaders over the decades. I'll just put it that way. That it wasn't like it sort of came out of a vacuum. You know, later, after my mission, I remember reading Ezra Taft Benson's talk, you know, Civil Rights, Tool of Communist Deception, you know, General Conference, you know. But I wasn't really aware. And at the time, he said, like, you know, I'm not really into, like, churches with extreme doctrines. I remember thinking, what extreme doctrines? Like, you know, what? I mean, this, like, these are all true. I mean, you're saying, you know, I'm thinking, like, using the word extreme like it's bad. I mean, there can be no such thing as bad if they're true. Well, anyway, right as I handed him this Book of Mormon, my dad leapt up and whipped out the camera. You know, so it was like Mormon ambush. And I noticed that Bono, like, slid the Book of Mormon down beside his leg before my dad clicked. And I suppose now that, you know, tonight sort of have a photo circulating that appeared to have him endorsing the, you know, the church, I guess. As we spoke, you know, like, to try to ease the tension in the room. And by the way, like, as I'm in there, like, making a fool of myself with this fellow, there's, like, an entire world outside the room who would, like, kill to talk to this guy. You know, and, you know, about all kinds of, you know, like, you know, how do we help people, you know, how do we keep people from starving and things like this. And I'm in there, like, you know, whatever. I said, you know, I saw you guys at the Cow Palace outside San Francisco. And he went, you mean you've seen us before? And, you know, this is one of the things that happened, came up during the conversation. I shot a glance at Dad. And I knew instantly that Dad had, one of his pitches had been, well, my son's never seen you guys before, and he's going to Argentina to risk his life for 2 years to help poor people. You know, can he please come and meet you? So I shot this look at Dad, you know, because Dad can be, you know, something of a storyteller. You know, he had this look on his face like, well, I got you in, didn't I? Anyway, the meeting finally left, and, you know, I didn't really seem to go as well as I had anticipated, but I still felt pretty good about myself because at least Bono had had his chance in mortality. Yeah, anyway, I was like Lorenzo Snow giving the Book of Mormon to Queen Victoria, in my mind anyway. Well, I went on my mission. I was very shocked by my arrival in Utah. I'd visited every once in a while, but to actually try to live in Utah was was, you know, I'd sort of grown up in northwestern Washington State and British Columbia, and when I came down, like, there were flags everywhere, and the Ollie North scandal was going, and I was just, I'd never really seen anything like that. And I remember during the interview for my mission, I sat down with Bishop Allen in Logan there, my mom's ward, and one of the questions he asked, and I wasn't particularly partisan or anything, I was just kind of surprised at, I mean, how staunchly Republican everybody was. And so I remember in the interview for my mission, Bishop Allen said, "Do you associate with any groups which hold teachings contrary to the teaching, you know, apostate groups?" And I said, "You mean like the Democratic Party?" I thought he was going to laugh, right? Because nobody that, well, he stiffened right up and he said, "You know, Talmadge, my grandfather was the founder of the Cache County Democratic Party." And it turns out he was like a staunch Democrat. Anyway, went on my mission, came back, and eager to throw myself wholeheartedly into the thing. I came back to Logan, went to Utah State. I actually wound up as a delegate to the Cache County Convention. I was there during the Senate race. So Bob Bennett was running, and Joe Cannon was running, and a couple other people were running. And I won't bore you with all the strange stories that happened. I was very fanatical. I was reading, you know, like all kinds of, you know, as I thought, you know, sort of, you know, the right kind of political literature from our past prophets and apostles. So I was very eager to sort of do my part. And I remember in the lobby during one of the breaks at this convention that Bob Bennett was there and people were asking him questions. And so I asked him a question about trade with communist China. And, you know, it's funny. I caught him flat-footed. He didn't really know how to respond. And he kind of stumbled and he started to mumble. Well, it was like prey drive or something, like with a dog. It's like, you know, well, what do you mean you don't know? I mean, you're running for Senate. Well, you know, it's funny. Within a few seconds, like, Bob Bennett and I had sort of squared off, and there was a circle of these other, like, you know, eager, just, you know, returned missionaries, like, you know, fiery Republican kids. And we sort of went head-to-head for, like, 5 or 6 minutes. And I just sort of lost my mind, you know. We were, like, battling back and forth, and I walked away thinking, like, this guy is a write-off. He'll never win. He's not conservative enough. Anyway, and for months afterwards, I would sort of meet people around Logan that had sort of been there. Anyway, I won't digress into like my experiences with this sort of right wing thing. But anyway, well, I got back from my mission, got married. Tracy and I went to California for a while. We lived in California. I met at a party one night Jackson Brown, the singer-songwriter. I mentioned this on the RFM board once, and got to talk. He was there with Daryl Hannah. This was before they'd broken up, and I was like, "Oh, cool, Jackson Brown." And we got to talking. As it happened, he was really into like Latin American things. So when he found out I'd been to Argentina, he was very excited. And I said, "Well, I brought back one of those charangos, which is a little 10-string instrument." And he went crazy. And he was like, "You know, man, I'm like recording with this Irish band right now. We're doing this track. And, you know, it'd be really cool, like, if you came and you had the charango, we put it on the song. And it just, you know, it'd be really cool." And I was like, "Well, what? Tell me about the song." He said, "Well, it's called The Rebel Jesus. And it's all about, like, how Jesus was, like, you know, rebel." You know, okay, I got that from the title, but he's like, you know, people didn't understand what it was all about. So, well, I'm thinking, like, as he's saying this, you know, and I'm like reading, like, An Enemy Hath Done This, you know, as they're tapped dancing at home as this is going on or whatever. I'm thinking, like, you know, okay, he's one of these crazy leftists like Che Guevara. You know, I'm going to go, you know, like, what would Ezra do? So, he, you know, it's funny, like, so Jackson Brown gives me his phone number, and he's, like, begging me to come over to his house to lay charango down on this track about, like, the rebel Jesus, who I'm thinking they've sort of reconfigured into this leftist icon. And I get home, I'm like, what would Ezra do? And he's like, there's no way he would participate in something like this. So I was like, you know, forget. So I threw the number away, and I never went. And then years later, I got the Chieftains' Christmas album. The Chieftains are a very popular Irish folk band. You know, I mean, there's nothing. And the song "The Rebel Jesus" is on it. And it's a very inspiring song. It has nothing to do with promoting international communism. And I love the album. It's great. But every time I hear it, I'm like, I could have been on that track. What was I doing? Anyway. Tracy and I got married, started having kids. We're very devout members of the church. So as I said, we never had a complaint. It was everything that we had, it was everything to us. We met through the church, and any doubts that I might have had as a teenager were long since gone, and I was eager to just, be the best Mormon I could be. And to that end, I bought all kinds of books. I was always studying. We always, had a zillion callings going on. And as it happened, I ended up getting a record deal. And it's funny, when you get a record deal, you suddenly get like a team of people, like lawyers and accountants and all kinds of things, and they start advancing you money. And it's not like it's not like Sam Walton that starts off with like a dime store or something and then builds it up over 25 years into a big thing. You go from zero to like a thousand, to light speed overnight. It's not like you start off with one lawnmower and then work your way up. So we went from poor to all of a sudden I'm getting these checks and I don't really know what to do with them, but they're to sort of like help me to record an album, and these accounts that we got to take this there and that there. Long story short is I lost track of how much money was actually sort of coming to us, and so I was unable to track what tithing I should pay. And it went on for like months and months, and I kept trying to figure out like how much did I actually owe. And as the weeks wore on, I just got more and more terrified, because Jesus was coming any day and we would all be fried. And I have like four little kids, and this is unacceptable. And here I've gotten this record deal because I went on a mission, and I now am repaying the Lord with ingratitude. And I don't even know what it is. Well, I finally sort of gave up trying to calculate exactly what it was and just came up with sort of a rough number. That it sort of maybe passed in plus like lots of interest just to make up for my tardiness. So, but I had no way of producing this kind of money at the time, because it was sort of like a trickle or whatever, and it's not like I had a load in my bank account. So I mentioned this on the RFM board too. I'll mention it again. So the only thing that I felt I figured I could do was to sell my most valuable possession. And it was a guitar that the rock guitarist Eddie Van Halen had given me when I was on a tour. My dad opened for them in the 80s, and I went with them, and I ended up sort of hitting it off with my then guitar hero. And so I had this thing, and I was like, I can't sell this thing, because what if Eddie found out and he gave me this thing, and there's like three of them in the world. And it's funny, like the fear that you experience sometimes, and here I was a grown man, and the fear you experience of not doing what you think you're supposed to do is so great that, I almost considered putting my children up for sale. No, I'm just joking. It's like this palpable thing. So I unloaded that, sold it to my dad to do it with whatever he wanted to, and handed the church a check for $25,000. I'd like to have that back. Have you ever like been cleaning up and you find one of your old tithing receipts, and you're just like, knife through the heart, Anyway, every once in a while, my wife, I'll wrap it up here in a few minutes. My wife would have questions about the gospel. Very rarely. But would have questions about, where do these cavemen come from? And I was always very happy to sort of repeat, these fossil records, I mean, clearly, they're from other planets. God sort of recycled this material. I mean, that's why they're like 180 million years old. I mean, listen, Tracy, there was no death of any kind, animal or vegetable, prior to, like 5,700 years ago. I mean, that was the fall. No, nothing died before that. So, radiocarbon dating, whatever, out the window, recycled, whatever. And these cavemen, like, as I said, obviously these were people who started out looking like us, but the more they sinned, the more they regressed into, like, these weird cavemen things. That's what Joseph Fielding Smith had said. So, I ended up feeling really stupid, and after a while, when I kind of figured out what was going on. But a couple of things that sort of popped up during my, I don't know, during the previous few years. I'm like fast forwarding now to like the end of 2001. Like President Hinckley's comments about God and man popped out. They didn't mean that the church wasn't true, of course not. But, you know, if you have a theory of Mormonism, you have your understanding of Mormonism, and it's, you know, documented, I mean, you can document it to the hilt, you know, from the King Fall at Discourse all the way through, the entire structure of Mormon theology is based on the concept that God was once a man and we can become like him. And then somebody who's in, you know, I mean, he's in the ultimate authority position says, well, that's not necessarily the case. That sort of pops up on the radar screen. At least it did for me, and it happened a couple times. So I had a few sort of questions, not you know, about whether the church might be all it claimed. I already knew it was, but how did I miss this? How did I get this wrong? Because obviously I've gotten it wrong. And so those kinds of things led me to volunteer to be the gospel doctrine teacher in late 2001. Although I was, They say like the fastest way that to losing your testimony is to get a job at the church office building, but I think it's to be a gospel doctrine teacher or something like that. So I was the second counselor in the branch. The branch president was an elderly fella, and the other fellow was very nice, but I was really hyper. I was, you know, like, the, you know, I had a lot of ideas, and this branch was growing. It was growing, very exciting times, like 100, 110 people in it, and very sincere people, lovely people. We'd never been in a better situation, and but even though I was doing all these things, I wanted to be gospel doctrine teacher as well. Well, we were meeting in the Lions Hall, and we didn't actually have time to do gospel doctrine block. So once a month, I would do a two-hour gospel doctrine class at my home. So all the adults would come or whatever, and I'd try to condense the four lessons into two. Well, I never wanted to get caught flat-footed by any questions. I wanted to absolutely focus on the text of the Scriptures, because every time throughout my life I've had a question, and you'd go and, you know, find some source or something like that, and then it wouldn't check out with another one. The answer always was, well, everyone has their own opinions, and the only standard for official church doctrine is what's in the standard works. So I thought, you know what, I'm not going to be reading the McConkie stuff. I'm not going to focus on anything. I'm going to focus on the Old Testament. We're going to start at Genesis 1:1, and we're going to go all the way through, and we're going to, like, totally try to inhabit that world and see the world as they saw it. And so I got, like, loads of reference books. There are very few LDS commentaries for the Old Testament. But loads of things, everything from, like, the odd, you know, evangelical thing, which, you know, I got, like, one or two of those, to, like, Orthodox Jewish commentaries, to very scholarly things. And I went crazy. So I was like, okay, this is going to be, you know, I'm gonna totally, like, deconstruct this and put it back together, and we're all going to understand. So first lesson, much to my surprise, I found what I thought was a problem with the Book of Moses. It kind of freaked me out. I'd never heard of it before. All the traditional sort of questions that were, you know, that I knew had been raised by evangelical Christians, I'd never heard this one raised. And long story short is that Joseph Smith's Book of Moses purports to be a restoration of you know, the first chapters of Genesis as they originally fell from the pen of Moses himself. So when you are confronted with what to me seemed like overwhelming evidence that not only did Moses not write this, if Moses was a real historical character, but that not even one person wrote this, but that the narrative portions of the Old Testament are in fact a compilation of various earlier Israelite histories that which were later sort of redacted, they say, or edited down, kind of cut and pasted together by a subsequent Israelite historian, putting together, I presume, what he wanted to be the definitive history of his people. Well, once I sort of got into that, I was kind of so concerned, because one of the reasons I was concerned is because reading the creation story sort of broken out, like which author wrote which part of the story, resolved the Mormon theological conundrum of God can't give you a commandment without preparing a way for you to obey it, and the creation story, the Mormon creation story, which is that God put Adam and Eve in a situation in which they were forced to disobey him. Eve was forced to disobey him, and then, contrary to all imaginable standards of justice, punished her for it. You know, so like, how do I make sense of these two things? Like Orwell's doublethink. You know, it comes up in every class. It's like my whole life. Like, I don't get it. I mean, how could he do that? Well, we're gonna have to put that on the shelf. Which is like, you know, like unknow what you just knew. Okay, like rewind. It's like strike that from the record. Become unconscious. Become unconscious. Okay. By the way, so I write a letter to Dallin Oaks because you know, because I can't find, you know, because I'm like, why is this thing? You know, the other thing about the Mormon creation story is it's not really warranted strictly by the scriptures, the whole thing. So I wrote to Dallin Oaks and I was like, so, you know, long letter, very polite in tone, you know, maybe we should drop this from, like, the lesson manuals. The fact that, like, and I wrote to him because he'd given a talk on, like, trying to explain this conundrum. I didn't think he'd done a very good job, although I didn't mention that in the letter. Well, he wrote me back and said, told me to write to the First Presidency about it. Well, that freaked me out. I spent like the next year, you know, redrafting this letter over and over again. Well, that sort of triggered, that was like the first domino. Like then the next lesson was like Pearl of Great Price. You know, and I'm, you know, now like I'm sort of like, you know, I'm a little bit sort of shaken because of this Book of Moses thing. Well, I'm sure I'm not, people can relate to this. Now I'm looking at the Book of Abraham and I'm sort of peering over these facsimiles and I'm like, so somehow I never noticed that the sun is drawing its light from Kolob. You know, like, if that's not true, you know, I don't know. And now I'm remembering, you know, I sort of heard, you know, like, that there are these papyrus scrolls, and I'd read, like, the, you know, they lie in wait to deceive. I don't know if anybody knows those series of books about the anti-Mormons, and sort of been immunized against any questions about the Book of Abraham. But it's another big mistake. I ordered John G's book from the farms thing on the Book of Abraham, which is a very disturbing book for me to read. So I felt like it did not forthrightly address the questions, and I'm sure he would disagree. But it was just very disappointing. And that pattern would sort of repeat itself as I would sort of stumble upon new problems and try to go to sources. And you'd have like, three main points that you really need rebutted. And it's very scary when you're feeling rocked to go to people that are supposed to, I don't know, they're supposed to be like the leading thinkers on these things. And they either don't acknowledge what appear to be the main points or their answers are just completely unsatisfactory or rely on obfuscating things. So... and funnily enough, like that triggered another memory of being a TVM sitting in a songwriting room with Desmond Child, who's a very famous, very gay songwriter, and him blurting out in the middle of the songwriting session, you know, I used to be in a cult, and it was just, oh my God, I mean, it was like millions of dollars out of my pocket, you know, and I'm thinking, God, this guy's a weirdo, he's in a cult. You know, what kind of, you know, geez, so what did you guys believe? Well, it's all kinds of things about the stars, and it was just like, and I'm like, stars, and, you know, now I'm like looking at the Pearl of Great Price, and I'm like, wait a minute, maybe I should call up Desmond. Long story short, you know, each attempt to sort of resolve a problem would turn up three new problems that for some reason I'd been unconscious of, And one day I had this thought that really, you know, really got me thinking, and that was, the church is either true or it's not. If it were not true, how would I know? There'd have to be a way to know. If there's a way to know that it is true, there'd have to be a way to know that it wasn't true if it wasn't. What would be that way? And I couldn't think of an answer. And I knew that I should be able to think of an answer, because if there are really good reasons for believing something to be true, there have to be, you know, theoretically, other, you know, good reasons to believe that it was false, if it was false. So I couldn't think of an answer, and I thought, you know, maybe something's wrong with me. Like, maybe something's happened to my head. Like, maybe this is, you know, maybe my faith is based on something that... Why can't I think of an answer? And I began to ask myself little questions like, what would I think if I found out that convert baptisms tripled next year? And I think, well, God, you know, the church is true. God is, you know, shining his light on the nations and the gospel is advanced. What would I think if the convert baptisms dwindled by 80%? Well, I think that the church was true because Satan was fighting so hard against it. Every question I asked myself, I would come up with the same answer. The church is true. The church is true. Well, that kind of disturbed me. So back to the state president's office. He finishes reading my letter. I'm beside myself. I don't know who I am. I'm shaking. You know, I don't know how to make sense of the world. And I never even had a desire to get out. You know, it's not like I ever, you know, like, yeah, I want to drink beer, but I can't. You know, it was never, nothing like that. He looks at me and he says, well, candidly, it's not so candidly anymore. He says, candidly, I was in a meeting with President Hinckley in the 80s as a member of the bishopric. We went to the Salt Lake Temple. It was after the Salamander letter had come out, but it was before we knew that it was a forgery. And he began his talk by saying that he knew that the claims of no church will withstand the light of historical scrutiny, including ours. And he said that President Hinckley, who was then a counselor, concluded his remarks by saying that, but he knew this, that being a member of the church made us better husbands and fathers. So I said, I could not have been more shocked, but I felt elated at the time because I had come to suspect very strongly that Gordon B. Hinckley did not have an understanding of the gospel like other members, put it that way. Because people that really, truly believe don't say the kinds of things that he says about Mormon doctrine and history, in my mind anyway. And I said, so you mean you know that some of this stuff didn't happen? And he said, yeah. You know, so like, you know, this is the guy that like gives temple recommends. You know, like if he doesn't give you your temple recommend, you're damned basically because you can never receive the saving ordinance, the exalting ordinance, and you can't see your family. But he went on to say that he believed the church was true, but he also knew that some of these things didn't happen, and kind of what seemed to me to be something of a jumble. But basically the message was, but I'm indifferent. It's irrelevant. Whether this stuff happened or not is irrelevant because I'm happy where I am and I think it makes me a better person. Well, I'm abbreviating slightly. At the end of the thing, I was so shocked, and I was still in my callings, and I said, so, well, now that I know that, like, this isn't what it claims, and he wasn't, like, arguing with me. It was like, okay, yeah. But I said, well, so now that I know, do you want me to resign my callings? And he said, well, I don't see why you should. And, you know, like the branch president was about to be released. You know, and there's this thing, you know, maybe they'll ask me. So, I mean, I could be the branch president of that branch, knowing the thing was a fraud, knowing that he pretty much knew, and just keeping quiet. And I've gotten emails since, you know, like through RFM boards, and guys serving in bishoprics and state presidencies, all kinds of places that are kind of in the same boat. Very odd, and I'd never experienced it before. Well, I thought about what he said for a few days. You know, should I stay in? And Tracy started to kind of crash because of all this. I had not told her anything over the 2 years that this torturous 2-year journey. And it sort of hit her like a ton of bricks. So I thought, you know what, I can't keep my callings, and, you know, this is going to be a rocky ride. And I didn't know how rocky it would be, but I told the branch president, you got to release me, like right now. And the state president came the next Sunday, released me. It was the primary program, and we saw the little kids getting up and reciting their testimonies. And I looked at my wife, and she looked at me, and like for the first time, I was like, we sort of saw this thing in a different way. And I just thought, you know what, I can't. I mean, if this isn't what it claims, and I've based my whole life on it, and then this is like a stake through my heart, and I can't go on doing this, you know. No, of course not. And I guess just in the final few moments, I guess I sort of wanted to ramble a bit about the folks that email me sometimes and say, I know it's a fraud, but, you know, all my friends are in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to get out, or I don't see why I should get out, or I don't see why I should open my mouth or anything like that. When I was on my mission, we got death threats, and we didn't care about them because in the Doctrine and Covenants it said we would go to the celestial kingdom if we were shot. At least that's how we read the scriptures, and everybody else did. And they were real death threats, and they were real terrorists defacing our real chapels. And in fact, while I was on my mission, those two elders got shot in Bolivia. The church, people have died for the church, for this church, for Joseph Smith's church. Your son may not die on his mission. In fact, he might be one of those members or your daughter, might be one of those members that always seems to be okay, that is never sort of bothered by the psychic pain of having to believe two things to be true, which both can't possibly be true. But they might turn into fanatics like me and like other of my friends, who are sort of playing mind games with themselves in some country, and risking their lives for this thing. And I might even add that in the years prior to those two guys getting shot by anti-American terrorists, Gordon B. Hinckley was buying, quote-unquote, controversial documents which might be better characterized as seeming to be devastating to founding church claims, and hiding them in the church vaults. So when we talk about the case for truth, I think the question I ask is, you know, is it really worth keeping the truth from these guys when the potential cost is them getting shot? And if it's not that big a deal to be shot for the church, why does Gordon B. Hinckley and the other general authorities, why do they have security details? Why is it like, you know, the Pope showing up or whatever every time they give a talk? President Hinckley went to one of those guys' funeral and, amongst other remarks, said, "It doesn't matter how long we live or die, as long as we do." Well, it seems to matter to you, because you have the armed security detail. You know, and we're down in Argentina, and by the way, watching little kids go to bed hungry because their parents are giving 10% of their money, which is like devaluing by the day, to the church. I mean, I could go on for hours, but I think the bottom line is, like, if the church is everything it claims, then no sacrifice would be too great for it. Blowing ourselves up in a building, killing people, giving 100% of our money, handing over our 14-year-old daughters to the prophet to marry, our wives, whatever. Because if all of those things about it are true, and the president of the Mormon church at any given moment is truly the regent of the creator of the universe, who cannot lead the church astray, you have to drink the Kool-Aid. And I would have drunk in the Kool-Aid. Absolutely. Within the world of Mormonism, there is no out for righteous disobedience, or as Dallin Oaks put it, loyal opposition. There is no room within that world. I don't know what it's like to have been born and raised in Utah, but the thought of keeping my mouth shut to my children because I'm afraid they might lose friends about something that is going to inform the most important decisions of their entire lives, who they marry, what career they choose, what they, who they're going to be, all of those kinds of things, is just total parental malfeasance as far as I can figure. I mean, I don't know what we're doing. I don't know what a parent is doing if they don't protect their children from people or organizations that might prey on them, no matter how sincere those people might be or the agents of that organization might be. It's just not right. Anyway, I think I'm almost out of time and I should take some questions. But so.
Okay, it's about 5:02, but let's go like to 10 after, and then we'll squeeze in next.
Okay, yeah.
What were the circumstances of the Hinckley talk to your state president? When did that take place?
All I know is that my state presidency said that it was a meeting at the Salt Lake Temple after the Salamander letter had been made public, but before it was known to be a forgery. And honestly, I've never heard of any other mention of this thing. And I don't know that it's really even that big of a deal. I don't mean to make it seem like the big smoking gun or anything like that, because President Hinckley himself in public over and over again has demonstrated, at least to my satisfaction, that he doesn't have the kind of understanding of the gospel that most of his members do. I mean, when you tell a New Yorker reporter that you don't know what Brigham Young was talking about when are you a New Yorker reporter or something? What?
I'm from New York.
No, I'm talking the New York. I'm talking about the magazine. Brigham Young once said that if you pulled back the veil and to see God, you'd see Adam and Eve. And then he said, "What did he mean? I have no idea." Like those kinds of comments. Well, what do you mean you don't have any idea? Or what happens after we die? I don't know. I haven't died yet. I mean, these kinds of answers. I mean, when you're risking your life, on the front lines, you don't want to hear those kinds of comments. You know, is it true that Mormons believe God was a man? I don't know that we teach that. I mean, if I had a missionary in one of my zones, I was a zone leader almost my entire mission, like way out in the boonies. If I had heard one of my elders do that, I would have gone crazy. I mean, I would have gone crazy, pulled a Jedediah Grant on him. In fact, I did do stuff like that. I mean, I remember being on a bus with an elder from Ogden on a split. And I would do, like, bully splits where I would get my comp and I, we were both zone leaders. We'd split up and we'd work with the pair and we'd just, like, you know, like, let's go. What are we going to do, you know? And sort of force them in some cases to get going with the discussions. I said, well, like, you know, give a golden question to this guy next to me. And he said, well, no, I don't want to. I said, why not? He said, I'm afraid. And I remember, like, going, I'm like, what? You're afraid, you know, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Read it, elder. It's right in, you know. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but I would have gone crazy if I'd heard those kinds of responses in my zones. Anyway, yeah. Well, my dad was well known as a member of the church in the 70s, gave fireside talks, many of which I went to when I was a kid, that really inspired a lot of people. And honestly, like we still hear today, my siblings and I, from people that were there and how riveting an experience it was and how much they felt the Spirit. What is difficult to say when we hear that, though, is that let's just say that some creative liberties were taken with some of the stories. But not that I'm faulting Dad for that, but it just kind of, once again, like Paul H. Dunn and every other thing, raises the question as to whether feelings are a reliable way of ascertaining fact. My dad was in my gospel doctrine class in the branch. We were having a great time at church and everything. I figured out that it wasn't what it claimed. I blurted it out to my sister one day. She let on to my dad, and my dad started calling me to ask me what I'd found. My stepmother, his wife, had left the church 20 years ago, you know, 15 years ago, whatever, and it had always been a rift in their marriage. You know, you don't go to church. So every time they'd have a squabble or something, you know, it was like there was this thing there. Well, you know, what's going to happen in the afterlife if I don't have a righteous partner? So my dad started calling me, you know, what's going on? What's going on? What did you find? What did you find? And I said, you know, honestly, I don't even want to talk about it. I feel like somebody's, like, jackhammering my stomach or something. Like, I feel like vomiting. Like, I don't even want to talk about it. You know, like, there's this image you have when you're a member of the church, like, everybody who leaves the church wanted the easy way out or was offended or some completely, now it seems like, asinine, like, imaginary, you know, spontaneous creation of reality to protect your religious belief or whatever. And that the minute you snap, all you want to do is go shove pamphlets in everybody's windshield all over the place. Well, I mean, I don't think anybody should be ashamed of talking about their experiences, but I didn't have that kind of reaction. I didn't really want to. I wanted to keep on going to church, actually, because I didn't want to upset the other people who were so sincere and who based their lives on the church. Well, anyway, I finally said to my dad, "Look, if you want to talk about this, I'll come over and talk. I'll, you know, you can read some of this stuff or do your own research. But I just want you to know, I don't care what you believe. I don't care what you conclude. It doesn't matter to me at all. And I don't want to have an argument because I'd been, you know, I'd had a million arguments inside my own head. I was just so frazzled. I went over there." Told him what was up, gave him a bunch of stuff, all of which he read, and he called me like 10 days later and said, well, yeah, I guess we've been had. So he stopped.
I seem to recall, I don't know if it was the church's official website or a supported website where they were showing prominence in celebrity-type Mormons last night,
yeah.
And some other people. Whatever happened
I don't know. I mean, I never put myself on there anyway. Somebody else did, and I think I heard from somebody that they took me off. So. I mean, I think they were still playing like documentaries of my dad on KBYU or whatever after he left, but, you know, whatever. Anything else?
I just finished the book, Leaving the Saints, and you started out with a comment. They always say... Well, you can leave the church, but you can't leave it alone. She had an excellent comeback to that. She says, by that logic, the Holocaust and child abuse are true. Because
absolutely.
Any victim of a long-term abusive situation has a very difficult time of letting go of it.
Okay, yeah, good point. I mean, like, why have German historians been talking about the Nazis for the last 50 years? That must mean Nazism was true. I mean, you know, this is the same logic. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter, you know, it's like when you only identify yourself through one system of beliefs, and it's who you are, and it's your identity and everything. I mean, you know, like I said, that just doesn't happen. Just a couple days ago in the doctor's office, I read an article about ball players who retire. And they go through, like, the same things that we go through and that everybody else goes through, like, very depressed in some cases, and maybe angry or resentful that they didn't achieve everything they wanted to achieve. Within, you know, feelings of resentment, I guess, in some way that things didn't, whatever. Feelings of like listlessness and purposelessness, and you know, and Ricky Henderson now he's like 46, he's still playing ball in San Diego for like a buck a game. Because you just can't let it go. But, you know, I mean, you're like from the time you're three to the time you're like an adult, you know, this is what you are. You know, Nazis, Mormons, ball players, whatever. It's just being human.
What about your siblings?
My little brother stopped going like years ago, so he's never gone. But my other sisters go.
I know that a lot of people have been through all of the research and have really been interested in this, and I as well have been researching this ever since I found out all the problems with the church. But based on the fact that you were so into it, I mean, I think probably more than almost anyone else here, I'm curious to know if you still have references or documentation of that time period when you were so deeply into the doctrinal issues, if you had anything like that that you kept in your notes.
Well, I wasn't keeping a record of, like, you know, I don't know, it's sort of like coming out of a trance or something, by yourself or something, but I didn't really see it that way at the time, and I knew, quote unquote, that I was going to find, you know, the way to make every problem go away, because I already knew I was right. So now I've got three problems, each one of which seems to kind of torpedo the whole church, but that can't be. So I'm just going to, like, solve all three. Well, then all of a sudden I have nine. And now I have, like, 18. And then 27. And you know, it's like, you know, I felt like, you know, it's sometimes, like, so sort of swamped. And it never occurred to me to keep a record. I was...
We've come in on these people that have these problems, and they just say, well, we'll put this on the shelf.
Well, yeah, good question. Yeah, good question. I mean, I think, like, one of the best resources that I found about that whole weird mental process that you go through when you're trying to believe what some part of you but doesn't want to believe or sort of alerting you isn't true is George Orwell's 1984. And, you know, there's wonderful passages in that book where O'Brien, who's like the agent of the party, is talking to, actually I think I have a quote here, to Winston. All kinds of things, like orthodoxy is unconsciousness, and talking about, you know, I don't know, like, let me find this quote. Okay, this is O'Brien from Orwell's 1984. This was kind of more about, you know, reality or whatever, so maybe not the most appropriate quote, but O'Brien says to Winston at the end of 1984, "You believe that reality is something objective, external, existing in its own right. But I tell you, Winston, that reality is not external. Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else. Not in the individual mind, which can make mistakes, only in the mind of the party," in this church, "which is collective and immortal. Whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. It is impossible to see reality except by looking through the eyes of the party. That is the fact that you've got to relearn, Winston. It needs an act of self-destruction, an effort of the will." And after that passage, O'Brien holds up his fingers, and he says, "How many fingers am I holding up?" And Winston says, "Four." And O'Brien says, "What if I said I was holding up five? How many would you see?" And Winston says, "Four." And he's hooked up to a machine where he starts to shock Winston, you know, to get to, and I don't know. I mean, it's kind of an extreme fictional example, obviously, but I mean, like for me, I ended up thinking like I was sort of like diminishing my consciousness, because you literally have to render yourself unconscious of anomalies in this theory of everything. You have to render yourself unconscious that, like, you know, that A can never equal not A. black can't equal white unless I deny meaning to the concepts of black and white. But I have to become unconscious of that. So that in the end, you know, so you sort of embarked on this process of like self-annihilation, like annihilating your mind, which is like hardwired for truth detection. You know, and it's, I don't know.
I like what you had to say about parental malfeasance. Certainly you don't want your children going off on the wrong course. At the same time, you seem to be rather concerned that you didn't create too much unhappiness in these sincere branch members that you were teaching the gospel doctrine class to. Do you really believe that there are some people who perhaps are better off continuing to live and understand and be part of a program that is untrue, but that they're so dependent upon that they're better off staying with it and being content?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I don't know, like, if at some point, like, I don't know, I feel like in a way it's sort of like you wake up and you find out, like, you were born and came to, you know, grew to sort of into your conscious self in a wheelchair. And it's and you were in a wheelchair with all the people that you loved and respected most in the world, and they all told you that, you know, you all needed to be in wheelchairs because that was the right thing to do. And all these other people that you see leaping around or whatever, not really having fun, and they're not really doing things the right way. And but the fact that you sort of confined yourself to a wheelchair means that when you do try to finally get up and walk, you can't. You fall down, it's painful, it hurts, you feel embarrassed, you feel stupid for even having confined yourself to that in the first place. Maybe there's a point, you know, where literally you can never recover, you know, your ability to walk. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't. But I would say, though, that whatever good in the church is worth having is not exclusive to the church and can be had outside the church. With that, like, all of the weird, you know, other costs, which, at least for me, remained hidden when I was a member of the church. Because to acknowledge them, to become conscious of them, is to commit a thought crime. You know, so you unknow them in a weird sort of way. You notice a cost. Well, you know, these people seem... we're out of time. Anyway, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know, but I definitely do not think that you need a bunch of lies to live a moral, responsible life. You know, truth is good enough. So. Thank you very much.
Take a real short break. Let's take a 10-minute break and then get right back in, because if we don't, we'll just be late all the rest of the day. So we'll see you back here in 10 minutes.